The idea of having a quiet mind. When I first started practicing meditating, which I encourage people to do, not from any Far Eastern guru loincloth kind of thing at all, but as a way of understanding that there's another dimension. If I were to take you, the listener, and to put you in chains, and to put you in a dungeon, and to deny you light and human contact for the rest of your life, you would probably say to yourself, this is the end. I mean, this is the end. I can't handle this. There are some people, believe it or not, among us, who, if you were to do that very same thing, would say, this is a beginning. There's a whole world there. And that if you were forced, if any of us were forced to learn how to go into that world, we would discover many, many, many things about ourselves. And I'm talking about the world of the mind. It's not an accident that all of the great spiritual masters have encouraged a kind of meditation of one kind or another, and that most advanced people, most awakened people, practice it on a regular basis. It's not an accident. You begin to discover how slimy your mind is. The thoughts that you have all the time and how much disasterizing we do with our minds and how much stuff that we occupy our minds with that is so unnecessary and so silly, so foolish, so destructive, that quieting our mind and meditating really go hand in hand. Now, meditating doesn't require a lot of training. It doesn't require somebody teaching you exactly how to do it or whatever, because that defeats the purpose of meditating. When you meditate, you really want to go in there and quiet your mind. And what you want to be able to do in your life is to have an open but not a rampage going on inside of your mind, not a thousand thoughts barraging it. And these thoughts that you have, these are yours. These are your creation. I used to tell people, if you don't believe that you're in control of your thoughts, then I want you to tell me who is. You are the creator of thought, which means that in some metaphysical way, you're the creator of your life. Thought originates with each one of us. But most of us have trained ourselves to believe that whatever we think just sort of happens, and thoughts just sort of, I call it the pop-in theory, you know? They just sort of pop in, and I can't help it. I'm walking along, and they just, boop, there's a thought, and it's just there. And I can't help it, it just happened. That isn't true when you train your mind. We spend so much of our energy training ourselves in all kinds of areas. We train ourselves in business, and if we're going to get a new computer system, we go out and we spend millions of dollars in a company, and we train people how to work it, and we want to become good at golf or swimming or tennis or backgammon or anything that you can think of. We know that we got to go out and we got to practice, and we got to train ourselves. We train ourselves, and we ignore our mind, which is 99% of who we are. We just completely ignore it. Like there's no training available for our minds. And we can all do that. I've really learned how to do it myself. No one ever taught me, but I've really learned how to train my mind. And in a matter of a week, you know, when I used to teach at the university, I taught in Berlin for half a year. There were 70 students in the class. And I would have the first student introduce themselves and their name. Then I would have the second student introduce the person who was just introduced and himself. And then each time I would repeat it. And I'd have the third student introduce the two that he had just introduced plus himself. And we do that for the whole class. That's by the time we got to the 70th student, they had to introduce everybody in the class by name. And I would then repeat each one of them. And I just had a very simple technique for doing that. It was just like concentrated effort on making my mind remember 70 people's names in an hour and a half. Now, I wasn't doing it to waste an hour and a half. This was a class on teaching people how to identify neurotic behavior. And it's like what I wanted to do was to teach them that they could do things with their minds, just like their patients do, that they never thought of, that they never even dreamt were possible for them. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, they would have like 80, 90% recall. And by the end of the fourth or fifth week, everybody knew everybody's name in the class, and they had all trained themselves. And most people go out there and they're introduced to somebody and they say, hello, my name is Wayne. They say, well, what would you say your name was? They can't remember one person's name in 1 minute. And they think that, oh, I have a poor memory. But it's because they don't train. Well, the mind can be trained. And meditating is a perfect way to do that. And there's a wonderful world in there, in your mind. Quieting your mind means that you're no longer susceptible to all of the external influences that are around you. I'm always amazed when I watch the U.S. Open tennis championships that are played in New York right near LaGuardia at how the players are able to continue playing with jets going on overhead. And yet when I am really completely involved in a tennis match, I've had people where I've played, I've had jackhammers going next to me, and my opponent is going crazy. They have to go over there, and I tell them I don't notice it. My concentration is on the ball. And I don't hear that lawnmower going off or the jackhammer going or the airplane going on overhead. We can train ourselves to do that. And the people who are really good at any game or any activity that requires concentration know how to do that. Well, we all want to be able to be better at that. And we don't want to have our minds occupied, particularly with worry and anxiety and stressful kinds of things. So you have to learn how to focus your mind, how to get focused, and keep yourself from creating those kinds of thoughts that are always impinging on your consciousness. Miracles are available there. I meditated for a long time. It's like there would be a light. I would have this light that I would create. And it's really interesting that you can create a light with your eyes closed in a dark room. So you don't really need your eyes to create light. You need your mind to create light. Your mind can create light. And all of us do it in our dreams. We can create a color in our dream without any light. So that our minds are capable of producing that, and our minds can create smells, and we can create sounds. We do all of that in our dream, and that's just a pure thought state. So what you want to do is get to that pure thought state. I created miracles in that space for myself, and in the world that I came back to when I left the meditation as well. The result, the peacefulness, the harmony, the serenity, the energy that you begin to minute a day, put yourself into a sensory deprivation kind of atmosphere, a tub of water, under a tree, in a meadow, whatever. Just go into your mind and begin to see the world there. And you begin to see, as I said, how slimy your mind is. And before long, it's like you're only letting harmony in. This is what I believe any one of us can do. Any one of us can only let harmony in. We don't have to let anybody into our consciousness, because all they are is just thoughts anyway, unless they come there with harmony. Now, that's like a commitment that you could make, that if you come with disharmony, discordance, anger, stress, tension, you only get to my form. You only get to the package. But unless you come with love, harmony, serenity, peace, whatever, you don't get to who I really am. You don't get there, because I'm beyond the need to have conflict and confrontation occupying my soul. I just don't need that any longer. I'm past that. I've gone through the light. I look at that as no longer my need to prove that I can deal with it and handle it. That's gone. So I was on an airplane, and we were flying from Miami to San Francisco, and the plane taxied out. And it got to the runway, and there was a light that came on in the cockpit, and the pilot announced that we wouldn't be able to take off. We're going to have to go back to the gate, because the stabilizer that takes care of the wing flaps or something wasn't registering as working properly. We'd have to go back. There's going to be a two-hour delay. And my immediate attitude when something like that happens is, you're not supposed to get to San Francisco in 5 hours. Okay? That when my ancestors wanted to get to San Francisco from Miami, if they left in September, and if they got there in March, April, they considered that on time. And it was a good trip if half the people were still alive. All right? It was very successful. If they could get there, if it took them 9 months or a year to get there in wagons and so on, then if it's going to take me 2 more hours or whatever, and if the stabilizer isn't working on that aircraft in anything that stabilizes anything, I want to go back to the gate. Okay, I'm not interested in being angry about that or anything. It's a part of surrendering. It's just understanding. I was in first class. The stewardess was standing there, and she said, "Oh, no. Oh, no." She knew who I was. I had been talking to her. This is what I dread. I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "There's 176 people on this plane. Every one of them is going to say something nasty to me when they get off the plane. They're going to blame me, they're going to blame the airline, and they're going to..." I said, "But you don't have to let that in." She said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, you've got two packages, two suits that are protecting you from anybody coming to you with that disharmony." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you got your uniform." I said, "And that's one package, and that's over the other package, which is your body, and then both of those are protecting or covering who you really are, which is how you choose to process all of this and how you choose to think and who you really are." I said, "Each person that comes up by you and says something negative or nasty, you can just let that only be a message to your uniform, to your package. That's not me. And you can remind yourself, they're not talking to me. They can't get to me with that stuff. They can't have that. I don't let anybody come to me unless they come with love or harmony to who I really am. So you can just say, well, I'm very sorry, and have a good, and it's like, and you say, well, they didn't get to me, and they didn't get to me. They're not reaching me with that. And sure enough, she stood there and she watched as 176 people got off, and I'd say 150 of them said something nasty to her on the way out. And each time she just sort of smiled and said, yes, well, it'll be 2 hours, and she gave them instructions on where to go. And when it was all done, she sat down next to me. She said, that was fantastic. It's the first time that we've ever had a circumstance like this where I didn't let it bother me. I said, you don't have to let that stuff into your life. And the more you do that, the more you allow yourself the right to have only what you want to enter your consciousness. You choose to make that choice all the time. When I'm driving, when I see, and if anybody gives me, I don't take any of that inside. I just say, oh, that's them, and that's how they're reacting to my form. But if somebody comes to me with love, with serenity, with peace, with joy, with ease, whatever, then you can have all of me. I will respond back with that. So you let in whatever you want. That's what meditating does for you. That's what a quiet mind does for you. It allows you to select what you allow into who you really are without having to be a slave to every single person who's out there and every single action that's out there that doesn't fit in with the way you want it to be. Having a quiet mind in a practical sense is really understanding that what I'm talking about is not just for discussion. It's for application. If you're the kind of person who has your mind filled with 10 different things that you have to do, and that is producing anxiety, stress, ulcers, colds, backaches, headaches, cramps, runny noses, and all of the kinds of physical reactions and manifestations of that kind of thinking, then you have to look at how can you just get a blank mind, or how can you get a quiet mind? How can you just understand that, supposing you're thinking about, you got to get to work. You've got this report you got to get out. You got to get your taxes done. You got to stop and get some diapers on the way home. The kids need to have bananas, and they've got dance lessons I've got to get them to, and you know, an endless catalog of activities. By using your mind to do that and to occupy it all the time, none of that is going to get done. See, all of that is going to get done. Regardless, if you're the kind of person who does those things, it's going to get done. The question is, how do you use your present moments? See, any time you use up your present moment, or any time that you are thinking anxious thoughts, you're denying the present. You're using up the present moment. Instead of using it up in a productive, peaceful, serene, calm way, you are somehow believing that you can't get through this day or this moment any other way, that if I don't think about it and worry about it and be anxious about it. But the fact is, it's going to get done. Your taxes are going to get done. You're not going to jail. You're not the kind of person who's going to opt to just simply not do your taxes. You're going to get the diapers. You're going to get the report done. All of that, you're going to get done. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in the position that you're in. You would be doing something else, all right? So if you know that it's going to get done, the question is, what's the most efficient and effective and peaceful way to get things done? I use the analogy often of when you're in a hurry. Like when your body is in a hurry, that's when you're least effective at things. That's when you always drop something. You'll drop the keys, and then you'll fall, and then you'll start sweating. And then when you start sweating, you find yourself getting more upset, and you'll forget something. And you'll walk out the door, and you'll slam the door, and you left the key on the inside. Now you don't have a key. Now in the physical world, you understand that if you hurry and rush and are filled with 1,000 different activities, that you have decreased your efficiency. Why isn't the same thing true in the mental world? In your mind. If you are filling your mind with all of the things that you have to do and you're worried about all of those things and get yourself all consumed with them, then you're still going to be less efficient, less effective, and you're still going to be cluttered. At a moment like that, you put on a tape. If you're going to drive, you got to drive. You can't get the bananas and the diapers and the report done and the IRS taken care of in the car on the freeway. You can't do that then. You're driving. So why not be here now? As Ram Dass says, be here now. Hear some music. Put on a tape. Meditate right there. Don't close your eyes. But just, like, push it all out. Okay, it's all going to get handled. But meantime, I'm going to enjoy this. Meditating teaches you that you have the capacity to use your mind any way that you want to. And you suddenly begin to see that everybody else out there who is in a frenzy and all upset and worked up, that you don't have to go there. It doesn't have to be that way. Aldous Huxley, in The Perennial Philosophy, studied every age and every civilization and found that there were three criteria or three factors that were a part of every human age and every civilization that ever existed. And these are ages and civilizations that never had any contact with each other at all. Primitive tribes, Native American traditions, shamanistic traditions, Buddhism and Zen and Hinduism and Eastern philosophies and Western and tribesmen and cavemen, and like since all of recorded history. In The Perennial Philosophy, Huxley points out that there are three things that are part of every culture. And the first is that there's an infinite world beyond the world of the changing. There is something, there's some kind of an existence that is in back of or suffusing this physical world that we find ourselves in, that we are awake in. And everybody has believed that. Great. Knowing that there's a world, some kind of a world, infinite world, that is endless, an eternal world, that is beneath or above or beyond or something other than the world that we're in. The second thing that they've all believed is that that infinite world is a part of every single human personality. That it isn't just something that's there for some and not for others, but that it's a part of every single human personality. Every age and every civilization has believed this, that that infinite world exists and that it's a part of every human being. And the third thing that they've all believed and they've all written about and has all been a part of every culture is that the purpose of life, of being here, is to discover God, or to discover that invisible world, which we call God. Which some call God, some call other things, but whatever you call it, so it's like you look at that and you think, you know, you're writing about this and you try to think of yourself as scholarly and you don't want to write something or put something on tape that doesn't smack of being true, but yet you haven't experienced it. I mean, you're just guessing at it. And then what happens is you discover it. You go there. And once you have, like the first time I went there, and came out of it in a meditation. The only way I know how to do it. There are other ways I know, you know, and there are many traditions for finding that. Prayer, chanting, and just lots of different ways that people have had to discover that world, or even dreams and so on. And I went back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and I did it for 45 or 46 consecutive days. Every morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd go out, I'd find this place, and I discovered it all for myself. And I put myself into what Jose Silva called, in Silva Mind Control, called an alpha state, where you use the 24-second clock described in this program, and get yourself to that point where you are as light as a feather, where your head is like real light and woozy, and where your arms are real light, and where you're feeling, you know, really terrific. I then said to myself, okay, what good is it? You know, does it just give me an insight that other people perhaps who haven't discovered it don't have, or does it give me any advantage in any way, or, you know, what is it about? And all I can say is that after meditating each day, I was always filled with harmony. And that's why the quote by Pascal, that all man's miseries derive from not being able to sit quietly in a room alone, really made sense to me, because I could never imagine wanting to ever hurt anybody after coming out of that, because I was always, everybody I would see, I would just feel so blissful toward, I could hardly stand myself. I just would look at them and go, ah, oh, don't they look terrific? And it was a really loving kind of, and with my family and with everyone, I came face to face with this connectedness.
I'll tell you how I do it. Whether it work or not for you, I don't know. But it does for me. An alpha state is a self-hypnotic state. And a self-hypnotic state is the first thing that you want to train yourself to get to. In this self-hypnotic state, you go into what we call an alpha state. And an alpha state is really The same state that a dentist can put you in, actually put yourself in through the teachings of a dentist, in about a minute and a half, if you're willing, if you want to do it. What I do is I use a 24-second clock. And 24-second clock is the clock that they had a basketball game, an NBA game. So it's got these little lights, 24, then it goes 23, and these little lights, that, and these little dots that are in there to make up the two. Now, here's the rule. When you close your eyes and get into a very quiet space, and all you have to do, if you don't have time, is just take the last hour of your sleep and use it, because it will give you a real strong sense of total rest and energy like you've never experienced before. An hour of meditation will give you 8 hours of sleep like that. I mean, it's that powerful. But again, you've got to believe it if you want to see it. You get the 24 and you see the 2 and the 4. Now, I can do it right here. You can see the 2 and the 4. And then you see the 23. But you have to see it. You can't just say it. You have to see it. And you get to now the 22. And what you're going to do is you're going to count down to 1. But any time between 24 and 1 in which a thought of any kind other than that the picture of the number enters, you start over at 24. If you get to 16 and you say, God, I got a dentist appointment tomorrow morning. So, oh, there we go. Okay, 24. You're patient with yourself. Now, it'll take you a few days to get to 1, all right, the first time. You probably won't be able to do it, if you're honest with yourself, until you've tried this for a few times. But that's okay. You do it anyway. Now, when you go from 24 to 1 without having an intervening thought, you will be in an alpha state. You'll be there. The way that you know that you're there, just watch what happens when you raise your hands. You'll raise your arms up, and all of a sudden they'll go like this. They'll get real, very light. Or you're breathing. And all of a sudden your head will just go like that. It'll get very, very light. And you're starting to leave your form. You're starting to go past it. All right? And you do that. And then what you do is you, once you get to alpha, after a few days or a few weeks or whatever, when you're able to get to alpha, before long, you'll be able to go into alpha without the 24-second clock. You'll be able to do it in about a minute, just with some kind of an internal breathing mantra over and over again. Read Ram Dass's The Journey of Awakening if you want some specific techniques for that. And then once you get good at going there, then you start asking yourself questions that you may have about your life, about anything that you want, about struggles that you may be having with your children, about your relationships, about where you ought to be going, what kinds of decisions you're not sure about making, anything like that. You start asking those questions after you get into the alpha state.
How can you apply this in your own life becomes like the very essence of awakening. You can go into a sales encounter and meditate on it and see how you want it to work out. While you cannot control how other people are going to act or react in your own mind, that's for them. Each one of us is capable of doing that for ourselves. You can certainly be impactful on how that other person is going to react to you by how at peace you are with yourself and how unattached you are to whether the outcome comes out the way you want to, and being focused on how I can serve the other person rather than what is going to come to me. You're able to do that. You can do that in all of your relationships. You can begin to look for in your own mind all the beauty and the joy and how you want that relationship to be, and you can see it and you can ask yourself that. Like I give the example often of and the other self as a form. If you hear somebody say to themselves, "You dummy, you shouldn't have done that." You've got two people there. You've got the person who is doing the name calling, that is the thought, who's saying, "You jerk, you got that." And then you got the jerk who is the body that has to react to what kind of thoughts that you have. So if you call yourself a dummy or a fool or a jerk, you have a thought of jerk, and you have the jerk who has to react. And what you want to do, and what meditation can help you to do, is to bring into harmony those two selves, so that self one, the thought, and self two, the body, the form, are in unity, are in oneness, and that you are only calling yourself what you want yourself to be, and you are only seeing what it is that you want in your mind, what you want your body to do. So as you go into meditation, what happens is that you leave this body, and you enter into that invisible world, that formless, dimensionless world of thought, and you then begin to realize that you're not even your thoughts, that you almost are watching yourself from a consciousness point of view. You're watching yourself think, and then you watch yourself react to the thoughts. And you can literally ask yourself, what's the solution to this? Or what can I do? Or why is this a problem for me? Or why am I creating this in my life? Or why am I having such a difficult time with my wife? Or why am I always having so much time with this particular person on the job? Or what is it about me where I always create I set up myself to fail? Answers begin to come floating right into your consciousness from a higher part of you, which you'll never see if you don't believe. And you can begin to apply this. There's a wonderful story of a man who was bothered and troubled by a car honking. He is awakened by this car that is honking for his neighbors next door. He says to his wife, "If I had magical powers, I would be able to put 4 flat tires into that car every time he comes here." And his wife said, no, you don't have it yet. And then he said, "Well, if I had magical powers, I'd be able to put a silencer on that horn, and I wouldn't even be able to hear that horn. That's what I could do if I had magical powers." She said, "No." She said, "If you had magical powers, you wouldn't be disturbed by that horn."